Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Epochs! Hello and welcome back to Epochs, where I shall be continuing my story of the Wars of the Roses, the story of King Henry VI, the old mad King Henry VI, and the younger usurper Edward IV, and the story of the rivalry between the House of Lancaster and the House of York. If you remember last time, we left off where, Warwick, the Kingmaker, the king's cousin, and the king's younger brother, Clarence, had been defeated. They tried to rise up against Edward. They'd successfully done it, but then let him go. Then he 180'd them and reversed them, and now they were on the back foot, and they had to run away to France. And so they're now in France, and they made common cause with their arch-Lancastrian enemy, who had been defeated years earlier and was in exile in France, Margaret of Anjou, the queen. The king himself, the old king, Henry VI, is in the Tower of London, as a prisoner, has been for a fair few years. But his wife and his son, who's now like a teenager, and Edward, the Prince of Wales, they're in France and they've just been there licking their wounds, hoping that things might change in England. Well, things have changed to the extent that Warwick, the Kingmaker, and a whole bunch of his retainers, and of course all his money and influence, are now just as exiled and outed and out of favour and in a spot of strife as she is. So they're now, even though they hate each other, they've killed many, many members of each other's family, or had them killed, but now they've got common cause, i.e. Edward. Both of their arch enemy now is Edward. So even though they hate each other and have been trying to destroy each other for years, for a generation, as I say, many, many members of their families have died on various battlefields, now they decide to join up together. And what a crazy thing that is, particularly from Warwick's point of view. Well, from both of their point of view, really. They decide to join up. What a weird, kind of weird, as far as the story so far is concerned, coalition between the old Lancastrians, Margaret of Anjou, and Warwick the Kingmaker, the arch-Yorkist, the most powerful, staunchest Yorkist there is. Now they're going to join together. The idea is hopefully bounce back across the channel and confront Edward, try and dethrone him. And of course you would hope, probably, get the old king, Henry VI, the old mad king, Henry VI, who's still in the tower, get him back, put him back on the throne as a puppet. And then, you know, the idea being Margaret of Anjou and Warwick can rule together. How that would have really worked, surely their relationship would have broken down at some point. Who knows? But, shall we see how it plays out? As always, I'll be reading from Professor Sir Charles Oman and Sir Winston Churchill. Okay, so first of all, Oman says this, quote, "Then Warwick and Margaret joined to foment a rising in England. The numerous clan of the Nevilles," that is the Montague and the Warwick families, "the numerous clans of the Nevilles were prepared to follow their chief, Warwick, and the surviving Lancastrians were still ready to risk themselves in a new plan of insurrection. In the autumn of 1470, Warwick and Clarence landed in Devonshire and raised the standard of the imprisoned Henry VI. Their success showed the deep roots of the Earl's popularity, Warwick's popularity, and the precarious nature of King Edward's power. Simultaneous risings broke out all over England, and Edward, betrayed by most of his supporters, had to take ship and fly to Flanders." Okay, so let's just take stock of what happened there. Another complete 180. The wheel of fortune, the vicissitudes of fortune, flip another 180. Right? Warwick and Margaret of Anjou team up in France, bounce back across the channel, and immediately win. They catch Edward off guard, basically. I catch him off guard. He didn't expect that to happen, or for them to move so quickly, or for risings to happen, particularly all over England at once. And he didn't have a big army ready, and he was just caught off guard. And now he flees. He has to flee to Flanders, the Low Countries, modern day, you know, Belgium and Holland and things. So King Edward IV is fleeing with his tail between his legs. I mean, talk about 180s. It was a 360 within a very small space of time there, or a 720. It just keeps... Edward was on top, then he was defeated, then he came back, now he's defeated again. So a real roller coaster. Omar goes on saying, Henry VI was drawn from his dungeon. It wasn't really like a horrible, squalid dungeon. It was quite opulent surroundings in the Tower of London. But anyway, Omar describes it, his metaphorical dungeon. He was drawn from his dungeon and was for a few months again King of England. Wait, what? Only a few months? Don't tell me there's another 180. Well, okay. The next line of Omar says, but one more change of fortune was yet to come. All right, let me read to you from Sir Winston Churchill, who talks about the same sort of a bit of history there, and see how he describes it, because it's slightly different. He writes, he overlooked the effect, he being the Earl of Warwick, he overlooked the effect on Clarence, George, Duke of Clarence, Edward's younger brother, the son of York. He overlooked the effect on Clarence of the new marriage he had arranged for his daughter Anne. Do you remember the idea was that Clarence, the second in line to the throne, really, should marry Warwick's daughter, Anne, the idea being that should Edward fail to remain alive and Clarence become king, their children would be the kings and queens, right? Certainly a boy, son, would be the next king. And that would be Warwick's grandson. So his family would become the sovereigns, the kings and queens of England. So that's what he wants. He married Clarence to his daughter Anne. But Churchill tells us that he overlooked the effect that had on Clarence. Churchill says, a son born of this union would have had a great hope of uniting torn, tormented England. It was reasonable to expect the birth of an heir to these prospects. But Clarence had been swayed in his desertion of his brother by thoughts of the crown. And although he was now named as the next in succession after Margaret's son, i.e. the old Lancastrian Prince of Wales and Edward, that little boy that was asked what should be done with some captives. And even though he was like 7 years old or 9 years old, he said, behead them. That little boy, he's now a teenager. The Prince of Wales, Edward, destined never to be king. Bit of a spoiler alert, but bear that in mind. It's probably helped to bear that in mind. He, well, you know, should Margaret of Anjou and Warwick successfully go back to England and take power again, that Edward would be the next in line to the throne. But after that, it would be Clarence. And this had an effect on Clarence because he thought he was going to be king. Now he's like third in line after the king himself, his son, and then him. That's a shaky position. That's not a great position. You know what happens to extra princes who are a threat? They have to find themselves dead one way or another. So Clarence goes from, all right, everything's going to be set up and I'm going to be king in the next few days or weeks. It's going to be me. To suddenly, oh, I'm just like an extra prince and that's very dangerous. So, okay, that had an effect on Clarence. Yeah, you bet it did. Okay, so after he was named as next in succession, after Margaret's son, the value of his chance was no longer higher. Yeah, all his hopes just slipped away. Edward had been staggered by his brother's conduct. You can imagine from Edward's point of view, my own little brother, my own second brother, just utterly, utterly betrayed me, as well as Warwick himself, your cousin, your staunchest supporter of all time. But your own brother, you would hope that your brothers would stand by you more than anyone else. But no, Clarence revealed himself to have completely stabbed him in the back. Right, Edward was staggered by his brother's conduct. He did not, however, allow his personal resentment to influence his action. A lady in attendance upon the new Duchess of Clarence proved to be a discreet and accomplished emissary of the king. She conveyed to Clarence, like a go-between, she conveyed to Clarence soon after he had fled from England. This is in the period where they first flee over to France to make common cause with Margaret of Anjou at that point. She conveyed to Clarence soon after he fled from England that he had only to rejoin his brother for all to be pardoned and forgotten. You know, Edward has got a streak of clemency in him, hasn't he? And Edward offers that. He says, look, just come back to me, come back to the fold, and we'll work it out. We'll paper over it. The new agreement between Warwick and Margaret decided Clarence to avail himself of this fraternal offer, but not immediately. He must have been a great dissembler, for Warwick was no more able to forecast his actions in the future than his brother had been in the past, i.e., a dissembler. You know, you're able to lie and deceive and keep people guessing what your true intentions are. Yeah, a good actor, a good liar and actor. Yeah, he must have been. Churchill continues, King Edward was by now alarmed and vigilant, but he could scarcely foresee how many of his supporters would betray him. Warwick repeated the process he had used a year before. Fitzhugh, his cousin, started a new insurrection in Yorkshire. Edward gathered some forces and, making little of the affair, marched against the rebels. Warned by Charles of Burgundy, he even expressed his wish that Warwick would land. He seems to have been entirely confident, but never was there more a swift undeception. Warwick and Clarence landed at Dartmouth in September 1470. Kent and other southern counties rose in his behalf, Warwick's behalf. Warwick marched to London. Warwick and the Yorkists could always count on the southeast and London, you know, certainly more than Lancastrians. But then when it comes down to, would the southeast and England be more pro-Warwick or pro-the king? Well, in this instance, this time, Warwick. Okay, so Warwick marched to London. He brought the miserable Henry VI from his prison in the Tower, placed a crown on his head, paraded him through the capital, and seated him upon the throne. End quote. So can you imagine this, just to say, can you imagine this from King Henry VI's point of view? He's been in prison for years, defeated, in prison for years, and suddenly, pretty suddenly as far as he's concerned. Oh, you know, and suffering from all sorts of mental illness, some quite extreme mental illness, where he's sort of awaking comatose for weeks or months on end. Terribly sort of damaged mind, it seems. And he's been in prison just for years. And now, out of nowhere, Warwick, his arch enemy, absolute arch enemy, someone he would expect to kill him, perhaps any day. One day some soldiers might just come into the Tower of London with orders to kill him from Warwick. Warwick turns up and makes him king again. Takes him out of the Tower of London, his arch enemy. He's killed loads of members of his family. Takes him out like a puppet, exactly like a little poodle. Parades him through London, as we just told there. Brings him back to the Palace of Westminster, or wherever it was. I think it might be Westminster. And just reinstalls him as king. You know, don't worry about the old Edward IV. He's gone. He's not here right now, so don't worry about that. You're king again now. Here's your crown. Place the crown back on his head. Surreal, right? Weird and surreal. What a roller coaster from Henry VI's point of view, his life. Going from being a tiny little baby king. Remember, he was only like 9 or 10 months old or something when his father, the great Henry V, the victor of Agincourt and Rouen, dies. So his whole life, he's been told he's the king. From his earliest possible memories, he's been told, well, in the beginning, when he was a child, he was told, you are the king of England and France. You're the man. You're the centre of everything. And then over most of his adult life, it slowly crumbles and falls away from him. All the possessions in France, one by one, slowly slip from his grasp. And then England falls into turmoil. And slowly, even though there's some reverses and back and forth, slowly, one by one, he keeps losing battles and losing territory and losing favour and losing power until in the end he's defeated and taken into captivity. But then he's restored and released and then taken into captivity again. And now put back on the throne again. Crazy. A crazy thing. But, of course, nothing is over. Edward has only run away. He's not dead. So let's let Churchill continue. He says, King Edward... Oh, no, we read that bit, sorry. Churchill says, quote, at Nottingham, Edward received alarming news. The major part of his kingdom seemed to have turned against him. Seemed. Well, had, to an extent. Suddenly he learned that while the northern rebels were moving down upon him and cutting him from his Welsh succours, and while Warwick was moving northward with strong forces, Northumberland, Warwick's brother, the Earl Montagu, hitherto faithful, again, firmly in the Yorkist camp, couldn't be more in the Yorkist camp, and always seemed completely loyal to the king, that he had made his men throw up their caps for King Henry, right? Crazy turn of events. This is the biggest 180 so far. Sort of a crazy, almost unbelievable 180. You imagine it from Edward's point of view. How is this happening? I've won all the battles over years and years and years. I've been king here for quite a while. Everything's been in place. We've stamped out all Lancastrian dissent and rebellion again and again and again. Everything's been quiet for quite a while. And now, one of my staunchest supporters, again, a relative, a cousin, someone who you should be able to rely on in the darkest, darkest of times, has suddenly, become a Lancastrian? Is suddenly, well, obviously, Lord Montagu's got word from his brother, Warwick, that he's made a pact with Margaret of Anjou. And this is the deal now. This is the story now. Yeah, the massive turn of events that Warwick and Margaret of Anjou put aside their vast differences to make a pact. Crazy as that is. Unbelievable as that is. Word's got to Montagu. And so, it's a surprise to Edward. But yeah, he now gets his men to throw up their caps for King Henry. Churchill goes on and says, when Edward heard of Northumberland's desertion, and also of rapid movements to secure his person, he deemed it his sole hope to fly beyond the seas. He had but one refuge, the court of Burgundy, and with a handful of followers, he cast himself upon his brother-in-law. So, King Edward IV, usually, nearly always, but not always, lucky in war, a great leader, a great general, a great warrior, this time just finds the deck suddenly, very suddenly, completely stacked against him. And he can't even go through that process of raising men, raising an army, and having a big battle somewhere. No, he's got no option but to flee. I mean, this is the biggest 180. It really is. So she said, Charles the Bold was also cautious. That is the Duke of Burgundy, where Edward's fled to. Charles the Bold was also cautious. He had to consider the imminent danger of an attack by England and France united. Because remember, Burgundy isn't France, like the Kingdom of France and Burgundy, the Duchy of Burgundy are two different things, completely two different political entities. Until he, the Duke of Burgundy, Charles the Bold, was sure that this was inevitable, he temporised with his royal refugee relation. But when it became clear that the policy of Warwick was undoubtedly to make war upon him in conjunction with Louis the XI, the King of France, he defended himself by an obvious manoeuvre. He furnished King Edward with about 1,200 trustworthy Flemish and German soldiers and the necessary ships and money for a descent, i.e. go back to England. And we're told these forces were collected secretly in the island of Walcheren. Okay, so Edward had to flee, had to fly for his life over to Burgundy. Burgundy realises he's about to get invaded by England and France if he keeps that up. Sort of the only thing he'll do, because he'll almost certainly face defeat, probably anyway, if that happened. One thing he can do to throw a spanner in that, well, exactly as we said there, give Edward some men and money and ships. A small number, it's a small number, isn't it? But do that, give that to Edward, send him back to England. That will totally, whether he wins or loses, that buys the Duke of Burgundy a bunch of time, doesn't it? That totally throws a spanner in this French-English alliance against him. That would, they would absolutely, or England would, absolutely have to turn all of its attentions away from trying to invade Burgundy at that point. They would just have to deal with Edward first. So that's what he does. And this gives Edward IV, this son of York, the eldest son of York, it gives him a glimmer of hope because he is a great warrior. He is a great general. We know this. He's proven that over and over and over again. If you give him a chance, just a chance, it's usually all he needs. Although he has got very few men. We're told there 1,200 trustworthy Flemish and German soldiers. 1,200? That's not big, even for the mid-15th century. And armies were a lot smaller than they were 100 years before that, or 200 years before that. But nonetheless, 1,200, that's not very many at all. That's almost a token force. But you have to use it to try to raise more. All right, let's let Churchill continue the story for us. He says, meanwhile, the kingmaker ruled England. I mean, right there, that's important, right? So it's obviously not Henry VI himself. He hasn't been able to rule anything more or less his whole life, certainly not in the last 20 odd years. You might think there'll be a power struggle, and there sort of was, but we'll get to that in a moment. Power struggle between Margaret of Anjou herself and the Earl of Warwick, the kingmaker. But at this point, it's just Warwick. Warwick rules England. And it seemed that he might long continue to do so. He had Henry VI, a puppet in his hand, the unhappy man, a breathing ruin, sitting like a sack upon the throne, with a crown on his head and a sceptre in his hand, received the fickle caresses of fortune with the same mild endurance which he had shown to her malignities. I.e. Henry VI is a bit past caring, or perhaps even being able to understand. Oh, I'm in the tower now. Oh, okay, fair enough. Oh, I'm king again now. Oh, okay, fair enough. Yeah. I mean, he's beyond weak-minded. He's beyond weak-willed. He's sort of, well, Churchill describes him there as what, like a sitting like a sack upon the throne, a breathing ruin. Yeah, he's simply a pawn to be moved around and has been for quite a few years now. So no wonder this is how he does it at this stage. Churchill said, statutes were passed in his name, which annihilated all the disinheritances and attainders of the Yorkist Parliament. Do you remember when Edward finally got in after Towton? Parliament passed various laws, various statutes, saying that all the Lancastrians will be disinherited and outlawed one way or another, certainly disinherited. Well, it was part of the deal with Warwick now, with Margaret of Anjou, that all that will be reversed. So he does. Churchill says, a third of the land of England returned to its old possessors. Think about what an upheaval all of this is. You know, all the Lancastrians completely dispossessed, given to Yorkist supporters, and then reverse all of that. Oh, absolute nightmare. Nightmare thing. Okay, Churchill said, the banished nobles, or the heirs of the slain, returned from poverty and exile to their ancient seats. Meanwhile, all preparations were made for a combined attack by England and France on Burgundy, and war became imminent. But while these violent transformations were comprehensible to the actors, and the drama proceeded with apparent success, the solid bulk of England on both sides were incapable of following such too quick movements and reconciliations. Remember, we're living in a world where there's obviously no telecommunications. There's not much communication at all. So if nobles keep making deals with each other and backstabbing each other, that won't filter down to the average person perhaps at all, perhaps ever. But even people that are in the know might not understand or get the news very quickly at all either. Right, imagine that you're sort of a minor, let's say you're a minor Yorkist noble and you live up in Cumbria or something. You may not find out that Edward's been imprisoned, then released, then forced to flee again, and now he's returned. You might not have any of that. You certainly wouldn't have any idea that the Earl of Warwick's out of nowhere has made a compact with Margaret of Anjou. All these things. So, yeah, we live in a world where news only travels as fast as a horse, but even then, the secret machinations of the various people involved, the most senior actors involved in all of this drama, don't filter down very far at all, and certainly not quickly, which just will cause all sorts of confusion and alarm and dismay. People finding themselves on the wrong side of history very quickly without even realising they were. All that sort of thing. Okay, so Churchill says, most people on both sides were incapable of following such too quick movements and reconciliations. Almost the whole population stood wherever it had stood before. Their leaders might have made new combinations, but ordinary men could not believe that the antagonism of the red and white rose was ended at the houses of York and Lancaster. It needed but another shock to produce an entirely different scene. It is significant that, although repeatedly urged by Warwick to join him and her husband, King Henry, in London, and although possessed by effective forces, Margaret remained in France and kept her son with her. That's sort of important. So, you know, Warwick has successfully invaded England, forced the king to flee. He's in London. He's got King Henry out of the tower, put him back on the throne, put a crown on his head, etc., etc. But Margaret of Anjou herself, wily old witch that she is, remains in France, where she calculates she'll be safest. Okay, Churchill says, in March of 1471, Edward landed with his small expedition at Ravenspur, a port in Yorkshire, now washed away by the North Sea, but then still famous for the descent of Henry Bolingbroke in 1399. Do you remember I've covered it in epochs? If you've watched all the epochs, you'll certainly know. Henry Bolingbroke, Henry IV, i.e. this old mad puppet king, Henry VI, his grandfather, you know, had been disinherited and exiled by Edward II, the son of the Black Prince, the grandson of Edward III. But he'd come back. It's a famous date in English history, 1399, when Bolingbroke, Henry IV, landed, you know, ultimately deposed Richard II, usurped him. I mean, that's what the Yorkist claim is based on, that usurpation. And the true Plantagenet line ended once that Richard II was killed, executed, murdered, perhaps died of natural causes, almost certainly didn't. But okay, so now Edward IV here is sort of recreating that 70 years later. Churchill says, the king, fighting for his life, was, as usual, at his best. We know, don't we, that's part of Edward's character, that when his back is up against the wall, when it's all or nothing, and there's daring do and battles to be had, that's when he shines. York shut its gates in his face. That's the town of York, that is. Because the town, city of York, is actually a Lancastrian stronghold. Nearly always. Mostly. Originally, let's say. Put it that way. So it shut its gates in his face, but like Bolingbroke, he declared he had only come to claim his private estates, not the crown itself, and bade his troops declare themselves for King Henry VI. So he's playing some subterfuge here. Accepted and nourished on these terms, he set forth on his march to London. Northumberland, with four times his numbers, remember that's Warwick's brother, outnumbered him 4-1, approached to intercept him. Edward, by extraordinary marches, manoeuvred past him. All Yorkist lords and adherents in the districts through which he passed joined his army. So it's funny, not long before, when he was forced to flee, everyone was deserting him. This time, they're all flocking to him. So it only seemed like before everything was lost and everyone had turned against him out of the blue. It only seemed that that was the case. Ultimately, most people, as we've described, were kept the same loyalties that they always did. If you were a good loyal Yorkist and suddenly, because Warwick's made a deal in France with your arch enemy, that doesn't actually make you a Lancastrian now, does it, suddenly? No. Well, just because Warwick's done a deal, I've got to change everything I think and believe and grew up thinking and believing and fighting for. No, no, no. So that was a very weak, paper-thin veneer of a political solution for Warwick to make common cause with Margaret of Anjou and reinstall Henry VI on the throne. Most Yorkists actually are Yorkists, surprise, surprise, do actually want to see Edward on the throne because it's in their interests. Churchill says, at Warwick, the city of Warwick, he was strong enough to proclaim himself king again. The kingmaker, the Earl of Warwick, disconcerted by the turn of events, another 180 on the cards, is it? Looks like it. So the kingmaker, the Earl of Warwick, disconcerted by the turn of events, sent repeated imperative requests to Margaret to come at once with an army, that is, of course, not just her, to bring an army and all her money and influence and everything. And at Coventry, stationed himself in King Edward's path, Warwick did. Meanwhile, his brother, Northumberland, followed Edward southwards, only 2 marches behind. In this dire strait, Edward had a resource unsuspected by Warwick, i.e. King Edward and his new army, based on the small number of Flemish and German soldiers he'd got from the Duke of Burgundy. He's actually a bit surrounded. Well, he's totally surrounded. He's got Northumberland behind him and he's got Warwick in front of him. He's going to have to fight. But he's got one more resource unsuspected by Warwick. He knew Clarence was his man. George, Duke of Clarence, who's supposed to be still in Warwick's camp, had actually turned against him. He's a right traitor, isn't he? Right little worm, this Clarence, right? Completely and utterly betrays his brother. Then, when he realises his plan to become king is not going to happen, it's not going to work, it has failed, he then completely backstabs his cousin Warwick to go back to his brother. So, he can't be trusted, can he? He's a real turncoat. A massive, massive traitor 2 times over. Okay, but he is now back in Edward's camp, although he's actually physically in Warwick's camp, and Warwick doesn't know. Okay, we're told Clarence was moving from Gloucestershire with considerable forces, ostensibly to join Warwick. But Edward, slipping around Warwick's flank as he had outmarched and outwitted Northumberland, placed himself between Warwick and London, and in the exact position where Clarence could make his conjunction with him. So, again, Edward IV doing a good piece of generalling. Not only is he good at actually physically fighting, if it comes to it, actual swordplay on the field, but he's a good general. He's got a good eye for, he's got a good tactical eye. You know, he has got like that the Napoleonic eye. He can read ground. He knows the value of being able to march well, march fast. How to successfully manoeuvre men and armies to your advantage. Just basically out-generalling whoever is against him. Churchill writes, both sides now concentrated all their strength, and again large armies were seen in England. Edward entered London and was cordially received by the bewildered citizens. Henry VI, the old mad king, who had actually been made to ride about the streets at the head of 600 horsemen, was relieved from his exertions and taken back to his prison in the Tower. Poor old Henry, eh? I always say I feel sorry for Henry VI, really. If he was a normal person, I wouldn't feel all that sorry for him, but he's obviously got severe mental health problems and hasn't even been trying to play the game for years and years and years and years now. I just feel sorry. I just feel sorry for him. He's being pushed around from pillar to post, completely bewildered, you would have thought. We hope you enjoyed that video, and if you did, please head over to lotuseaters.com for the full unabridged video.
Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Boda Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino's the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21+.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.